I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's The Breakdown, Jamali Maddox with The Hook.
Just been back from the Edinburgh Fringe got back yesterday night. Here this morning, got locked out of my house just today. I mean, last night. So I had to sleep on my friend's sofa after I haven't slept in my own bed for a month doing the comedy festival in Scotland. But my hair was looking rough. Got a haircut today. I'm feeling better. I'm not gonna do too much talking. I think I talk too much during the beginning of the podcast, and I don't want to hear my own fucking voice sometimes. So today we got Reggie Yates on the podcast, man. I'm gonna really be happy that he's here, man, because he's a real busy dude. You know, he's a filmmaker, he's a writer, he's a director, he's an actor, he's everything. Real multifaceted type of brother, man. He's a good dude too, man. I remember I met Reggie on his podcast. He asked me to do his podcast a couple months back, and I met him, and lovely guy. And we actually share a mutual friend called Yemi. And Yemi basically directed my Hate Thy Neighbor series, the second series on Vice. He done all 10 episodes. So I was with Yemi for 6 months. In America, traveling across some of the worst towns. Well, we went to some bad places, really boring places too, man. You know, that's the thing about America, though, is the big cities are fun. You know, you go Charlotte, you know, you go New York City, you go Miami, you go to the big places, and it's fun. Then when you end up in, you know, Boise, Idaho, it's a bit shit. So all right, man, with Reggie Yates, thank you.
Jamali.
Thank you for coming. I know you're a busy dude.
Yeah, thank you.
No, you're always busy.
It's good to be here, man.
Yeah, it's good to be busy.
Yes, yeah.
And that's the weird thing, isn't it? It's like, because, you know, it's in normal jobs, it's like people get stressed out about busy. If I'm not busy, I'm stressed out. You know, I've got to stay busy.
It's weird. I like to be busy, uh-huh. But in my old age, I'm starting to really enjoy. How do you think I am?
I think, do you know what? I want, because the way you said it, I think you're deep in the 30s, yeah. but you look after yourself.
Thank you very much.
The hairline's still there, and I've never seen Reggie without hair out of place. If you look at Reggie's Instagram, my man gets a fade with the scissors. That's how you know it's serious. I've never caught a fade with a scissor, you know.
I'm 35.
You're 30? Okay. Yeah, but so you're mid 30s.
Yeah, I'm mid 30s.
And you look after yourself as well.
I try to. I feel like well. I could be. I do eat relatively well now. I have got a sweet tooth though.
Yeah, me too.
I do feel like I'm in my mid 40s because I've been doing this for so long. And from the age of 8, I've been working. And when you're that old and your peers are people who are a lot older than you, and you know, the people that you're on screen with, your work buddies, if you will, are old enough to be your parents.
Yeah.
You kind of have to grow up quite quickly.
I guess you have to adopt a more mature attitude because you're not with your, you know, you're not with your own peer group in terms of age. You're with older people, and they're not going to put up with your adolescence.
See, I call it being prematurely grumpy.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
I like. Yeah. So I can have the grumpiness of a man in his 50s at the drop of a hat, and I think I've had that since I was a kid.
So you've been in showbiz since 8 years old.
Yeah, so nearly 30 Damn. Years. Yeah, it's been a while.
That's a long time in the showbiz.
Yeah, it's weird because I don't.
Has this been your only job?
I've never done anything else.
Wow.
Yeah, so I started out at this little drama group in North London called Anarchair Theatre, right?
Yeah.
And Anarchair had this thing on the wall.
It was in a church.
No, it's in a church now. It used to be. It is a charity, and it used to be in this sort of this beautiful building opposite Barnard Park. But there was this sign on the wall that said, "There's no such thing as star or fame," and so like I instinctively, whenever I hear show business or anything glitzy or whatever, I just kind of tense up a little bit because it doesn't feel like I'm part of that world, and I've never really been a part of that world.
Do you not feel part of the glitz and glamour of the what showbiz is? Because I think people do have a sort of misconception of what, because that showbiz is different to what I thought it was before I got into it.
Okay, yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying though? And it is that sort of misconception of what people think showbiz is. That's why I feel bad for people who get into, you know, I can only talk about comedy, and maybe this is the same for presenting or, you know, for filmmaking.
Right.
Is when people get into it for pure fame and not because I go, you don't know the thing you're actually getting into
at all.
It's a job.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, and you might catch a break and be famous and congratulations on that. But man, you know, it is a long road to.
Bro, it's weird. I don't look at it as show business. Mm. I don't look at it as the industry. It's just work. Mm. And that's the way that I've always seen it. So for me, it's something that I'm privileged enough to enjoy what I do. You know, I grew up around people that didn't enjoy work. Mm. And for me to be able to go to work and for it to not feel like a chore is a blessing, bro. Mm. But I've sort of got to the point now where enjoying what I do is sort of level one, level two is fulfillment, you know? Mm. So to do stuff that I care about, to do stuff that represents a legacy of some sort of value, that's kind of where I am now.
And what's the value? Like, well, that you're trying to have fulfillment for? Because fulfillment for everyone else is different. So yeah, in terms of your manifestation of fulfillment, what is that legacy you feel?
Well, it's creating content that actually means something, creating content of scale, creating content that I believe can affect change. Mm. And you're not going to do that with a Saturday night entertainment show. Do you know what I mean? It's fun to
and you
be
get a good check, but
it's fun to get the big bucks and to wear the suit, but and to get the fresh cut before you walk out and all of it. That's great. But really, when people look back, what have you actually done? Great, you've provided a level of entertainment, but what have you shifted? Mm. What have you changed? And as a black guy in this industry, there's not really many black guys, so I understand the role that I fulfill. Yeah. And I also understand the role that I could fulfill versus the one I want for myself, which I feel I've created.
Yeah, I mean, there is a, do you feel that certain point of, not necessarily pressure, but do you feel pressure or responsibility, which is different of pressure. Pressure
responsibility.
Is overwhelming. Yeah, because pressure is overwhelming. I think pressure is the wrong word, but do you feel like a sort of sense of like a strong responsibility of, if you're going to be a black man in this industry or in this job or where, you know, whatever we want to call it,
that
comes with a certain amount of level of, you know, being portrayed in a certain way? Because I think that's, you know, I think we can relate on that sort of sense of, I try to be, and I've got it wrong at times, I'm not perfect,
well, we all have,
and I've got it wrong, you know what I mean? But there's a certain sense of, I have to double think about how I'm being portrayed, because I don't feel it's just me being portrayed. I'm putting it onto a thing that's going to be seen by people. And it's like, even though I don't have this sort of idea of what I do is that influential, but it, you know, it's influential in a way.
Give yourself some credit, bro. You know? Honestly, so long as you are part of a minority in an industry, you aren't just speaking for yourself. Mm. And that was something I learned quite early on. I sort of rejected the idea of being a role model as a teenager, because I would have mum stop me in the street and say, my son's been watching you since you were a kid, and we love the fact that you're out there and you're a great role model for him. And in my head, I'm thinking, his dad should be his role model, not me. But whether you like it or not, people are going to look at you and they're going to be either inspired by what you do for better or for worse. Yeah. They're going to want to emulate it for better or for worse. So whether you like it or not, you have a relationship with people that you will never see.
Yeah.
And that was something that I learned, thankfully, quite early on.
It is that thing of, it's that strange sort of thing, dimension of, like, say, you know, like you said, and I do agree with you, it should be your parents that are your role models, but when we live in a time and place where it isn't.
No.
It is the person on the box.
Yeah.
So I guess you do have to sort of adopt that certain way of...
So on some level, it's always been that way. You know, even when we were kids, you'd look at Michael Jordan and say, I want to be him. Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately for us, there weren't really that many British black people that we could look at and point to, but there were a ton of African Americans.
Yeah.
So you might say, I want to be Criss Cross, or I want to be Fresh Prince, or I want to be this
Who
person or that person.
Be?
I want to be Fresh Prince.
You want to be Fresh Prince?
Who didn't want to be Will Smith?
Nah, I want to be...
You wanted to be Chuck D?
Yeah. I want to be Flavor. There's a place in Shoreditch, right? And they used to have, like, it was like a cafe, bar, and art gallery.
Right.
And there was this girl who, or dude, I don't know, but she had, like, they had painted like, and this was before the thing came out, and they had paint, and it was all the walls were covered in Bill Cosby photos, like paintings. So this girl must have been spending, I think it was a woman, and she must have spent like months painting like hundreds of to sell. And then the controversy came out. I'm like, yo, you're stuck with hundreds of paintings of people who, if they do want it, they're the wrong people.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to sell to those people.
If you sell out of those paintings,
for real,
you fucked up.
It's like someone who, it's like someone who still has a Rolf Harris painting, yeah, and they were holding on to it. Like, oh, yo, this is going to be worth some money. And then, boy,
I was
up
at a dinner. I can't tell this story. My Rolf Harris names story is probably...
Yeah, no names.
I can't tell
no
Rolf
names
Harris story.
No names.
I was just going to say, I was sat next to Rolf Harris at a dinner. But I won't say who was responsible for the dinner or what happened. But let's just say
it was wrong,
I have a story. Yeah. Insert story here. Yeah, it's probably for the best. Don't tell it. But the point is, if you have a relationship with one of these people who have come out to be someone who was heartbreaking in terms of their behavior behind the scenes, what do you do? Because I was DJing over the weekend and someone asked me to play R. Kelly Vibe.
Yeah.
And you go, yeah, yeah, sick, that, oh, that'll mix perfectly. Yeah. And then you go to put it on and you go,
because the thing is as well, it is strange of he is one of the few people where, I mean, well, I guess it's because he got not guilty. I mean, we're not going to debate the guilt of it. I think he did it. Whatever, but it's like,
there's
a video, right, you know. But it is that strange thing of, because there's a, I'm not going to say the pub, Dolphins, right, in Hackney.
Right.
They got that rule where every half an hour they play R. Kelly. I think they still do have that.
But every anyway, half an hour?
Yeah, it's like R. Kelly. That's like the thing they did at this pub. I don't know if they still do it.
Jesus.
But it's just like, you do go, yeah, he's one of the few dudes where people just kind of went, yeah. And it is a very strange thing of how we deal with sort of guilt but artistry at the same time.
Yeah. It? It's like that Chappelle routine, isn't it? In his last special when he talks about Bill Cosby. He rapes, but he saves. And it's like, it's a very dangerous...
It's a dangerous
it's
thing,
a dangerous territory to take your comedy to.
Gerard Carmichael had a bit that was even like more dark, man. He starts going, you know, I watched that new Robot Cop film. Terrible film. Terrible. But it was so bad, I forgave Woody Allen. And he just got mad. But, you know, comedy's supposed to go there. But we're not going to get into that.
I love Gerard Carmichael. You know, Spike Lee directed that
special.
Yeah,
that's a cold special, man. Really that good. First one, Love.
Mm.
Love at the Comedy Store. That's a cold special,
He's
man.
Good, man. He's really good.
You're a big comedy fan.
Massive.
Yeah.
I always have been. You know, I did stand up.
You told me, and you never told me the whole story, and I want to hear this story. So it's at the Comedy Store. All I know is at the Comedy Store, Jonathan Ross hosting.
Yeah.
So it's always bizarro world.
I was 13.
So you're...
Yeah, I did the Comedy Store when I was 13.
And
there
kill?
Was. Did I kill? Yeah. I think people were nice.
Yeah. people gave you a couple.
yeah, it was cool. Nice. It was like this young comedian thing that I think Fanta did. Did this massive young comedian of the year thing. And I made it to the final. And the final was at Comedy Store with Jonathan Ross hosting.
Damn. So did you. Sam, you done more. Pardon me. You done more than one set then to get to the final. How many sets did you do?
I don't even know. I was a kid. I was 13. Yeah, I don't remember. I mean, I was doing so many different things at that time.
Yeah.
Like I was presenting Disney Club at the time, and it was just something that happened that came out, and my management at the time told me about it, and I just went and I just stood up and tried to make people laugh in the way that my heroes did.
Did
you
win?
No, I didn't. I got to the final, and the kid that won, we don't see him anymore.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Who's that guy?
I don't know what happened to that guy. Yeah. But I thought I was good. Like, I remember telling silly jokes about my grandfather and like him coming over to England.
Have you always been that type of dude where someone just says to you, like, do this thing or try this thing, and then you sort of just go, yeah. Have you ever been a hesitant person? Because I mean, to start at 8 and then, you know, sort of perform. And have you always been that sort of person where you're just like, yeah, I'll do it?
Not because I've been told to. I've without realizing for a long time, I've sort of listened to my gut. If it feels like something I should do, I'll do it. And generally my gut hasn't been wrong in that way. So yeah, I'll sort of find things that I'm interested in and try it out. Now I kind of know what I'm good at, what I'm not so good at, and I'm focused on the things that really matter to me, you know.
So when you, because you, the latest things you do is the docs, which you made some killer docs, man.
Thank you, sir.
I love the Russia Extreme one. Do you know what my favorite doc is? I want to talk more about it. Is the one where you done the preacher in South Africa?
Yeah,
that for me is one of my favorite docs because I think it sort of added a new level of how can I put it? There was a level of honesty in that doc, which is hard to achieve.
Yes,
you know, because I think when people make docs, and I mean, I've made some docs, And it's hard to achieve that level of honesty because you're still trying to maintain relationship with the because you got, because people don't understand you're trying to work multifaceted, where you go, okay, I've got to maintain relationship. A lot of work's off the camera, we're still trying to keep the guy engaged and not scare him out, and, you know, doing, but just how much that guy pissed you off. And it was honest. Yeah. And it was so, and he was pushing your buttons.
Massively. I learned a lot about myself,
you know,
while making
and
it.
And he was selling sugar that was blessed and all this mad stuff.
Selling
mad stuff.
Blessed
and,
tampons.
And
bro.
Blessed tampons. And yeah. But you could see that there was some backstory with you, which I love most about that film. I think that was my favorite film, because there was some backstory with you where you've, you know, whatever your relationship is, religion, and why your relationship's like that with religion, and how this person kind of manifested the most sort of bad part of religion in terms of, you know, Christian preaching. Mm-hmm. It's the worst part. It's that sort of prosperity preacher shit where it's that, you know, you can be blessed but I'm from my pocket. Mm. You know, and how, you know, sort of, and how he was sort of just like sort of taking shots at your clothing and the this and the that, and how you don't respect, and it was such a good doc, man.
No, I appreciate that, man. I mean, I learned a lot about myself while making that film. Uh-huh. Because I was pushed in a way, yeah, where I nearly lost the contributor.
Yeah, yeah.
And as someone who makes films yourself, you know that the story is more important than you, and that was something that I had to learn the hard way on that, and in being faced with the potential of the film not finishing,
yeah,
and me completely losing my contributor, I had to sort of check my ego and say, hang on a second, this isn't actually about me, yeah, this is about delivering content that speaks to the issue that we're trying to discuss. So uh-huh, shut your mouth, step back, uh-huh, and allow this guy to be himself in his truth, as opposed to challenging him at every opportunity, uh-huh, which is what I was doing.
Yeah.
So in giving the story and the contributor room to breathe, I had to take a step back and sort of put my ego to one side, and we ended up getting a great film as a result.
So you start the film, when, at what point do you think, fuck, I'm losing this contributor?
It was quite early on with him, yeah, he
I'm talking about in terms of, not in terms of the film, cause I know in the film, but I'm saying in terms of actual filming day, when did you start losing this dude?
It was early on. It was like, yeah, 2 or 3 days in.
What?
It was, yeah, no, straight up. That's because joke. He is an African man in every sense of the word. And for anybody that doesn't know or isn't related to a very traditional African man, you may not be aware that respect is everything. Yeah. Same with West Indian culture. You know, you hear people saying all the time, I disrespect, don't disrespect me, don't disrespect me. That is because that is one of the highest forms of insult you can give somebody from that culture. And so for an African man who is the leader of a church and the leader of a congregation of,
of a community,
5 to 10,000 people, for me to not respect him in the way that these thousands of people do makes no sense. For him to look at me and know, yeah, I'm British, and yeah, I'm a reporter, journalist, or whatever I am, presenter, whatever I am in that context, but I'm wearing a dirty pair of Vans, some cut off shorts, and, you know, a t-shirt. He looks at me and thinks, they've not sent their best. They've not sent their number one news guy. They clearly don't think I'm as important as I actually am. You know, so for him, he felt disrespected from the jump when he saw this kid in trainers asking him questions and challenging him.
He wanted packs, man.
Straight up. So when I put a shirt on and I shaved, suddenly he was like, oh, okay, you're taking me seriously.
Do you know what I liked most about it is, and I understand, you know, and the people listening probably don't understand about, you know, having to maintain the ego, because people be like, why can't you say, because it's not that easy. You know, people at home don't understand that, or people listening on the train or wherever the fuck you're listening. It's what I liked most about that is you coming in the jeans and coming in the trainers, is the fact of, I think sometimes when you're doing a film and how they react to you is telling the story,
right?
Because it shows them for what they really are and how they react in the situation. Because me and you can have a conversation and you can, you know, blow smoke up my ass all day, but when you're confronted with that thing and it shows who he really is, and it shows the ridiculousness of it, like you're just wearing shorts and trainers and he's like, this is the most disrespectful thing I've ever seen, and you go, that's crazy.
But it was also because I was challenging him.
There was that as well, but I'm saying it's the little things of just like that little nuance of that he would get upset by that. You know what I'm saying? Just to play that out. And that's what I liked about it. Because it was that thing of, you know, and it is telling your story. So even though there is, and it's that hard conflict, I find the conflict when I'm making a film of how much of it is me and how much of it is them and their story, and how much of it is me and my opinions. Because a lot of time is, you know, when I was making my films, the big conflict I had with people was like, I'm not giving my opinion on this. Why? Because it doesn't matter what I think. It's for the people at home to decide, and it's for this person to tell you. And sometimes you have to give your opinions because you are the journey person. But I think you hit a nice balance with that. I mean, I wasn't on the actual location, so I don't know the ins and outs.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it comes down to understanding the role that you play before you even get on camera and being at peace with the fact that it's not actually about you, it's about the issue. And the issue is something that you get to and you arrive at through the prism of the people you meet. And yes, your personal experiences and your connection to the subject matter may get you there in a different way and in an authentic way. But as far as I'm concerned, that's the B story to the A story of the people that you meet. That just adds extra sauce to the meat of the film, which is the people. So I've learned that the hard way. I've got it wrong a few times.
Yeah.
And now I think I've hit a stride where I'm able to put myself enough in the background and give enough of myself when necessary to tell the story in a real way and also justify my reason for being there, because I'm not a journalist, so I need to sort of justify my opinion.
I think me and you are both the same in that we've done docs, but we are not journalists.
Yeah, it's nice. It's cool though. I think that's wicked.
It's all right.
I think it's you are the voice of the man on the couch.
You know what? I think, you know, just to touch quickly on what you said just there, I think, you know what is weird of being not a filmmaker and not a journalist, I just consider myself just a curious person
straight up
who's been given an opportunity. But getting it wrong, when I've got it wrong in films and I've done it wrong and I see the result of it, that there's something that hits me more than when I get something wrong in a comedy show. Do you know what I'm saying? Though? Just I don't know what it is, but it's something about getting it wrong in a doc where, like, I've asked the wrong question there, or I've pushed this person too hard, or I haven't pushed this person hard enough. There's something about when I make a doc, when I get it wrong, it's more disturbing to me than...
Is it because maybe... Well, I'm putting this to you. Is it because the subject matter matters to you in a different way?
Maybe it is. I still haven't internalized it to why, but there's something about the... And I think as well is I think it's kind of injustice because... You know, one of the things I don't, which is hard with filmmaking, is the idea, and I know it's just criticism, but it's when people say, oh, you fucked that person over. And I go, well, no, that's just what he said. And we showed it. That's not, you know. But there is that certain thing of I do, even the people I disagree with the most and I have vehemently different opinions with, you know, I try not to actually fuck them over. You know what I'm saying? I think that's important for me to try and get that balance. But it is hard, man. It's a hard, especially filmmaking is a totally different world, man.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of truth in giving people the space to be themselves. And that's the thing that I've had to learn the hard way. You know, when someone is saying something particularly offensive, you have to pick your moments as to when to challenge them, because they are who they are. You're not going to change them in a conversation. No. So giving them the opportunity to show who they truly are and to be their true self and say the offensive and shocking things is one part of it. But what I'm interested in is the why.
Yeah.
We've all met racist people.
It's not the what's.
We've all met sexist people. We've all met homophobes. But why are you the way that you are? And that's where you suddenly get some interesting content. Well, and that's where you find out what makes them an individual.
Yeah, that's why I say it's not the what they're saying, it's the why they're saying it, because it's the what's is sensationalism. Would you say filmmaking is your, because before you were saying, just to bring it back to what you were saying before, in terms of you sort of gone through these different manners, because you've done acting, you know, you've done presenting, like on Top of the Pops, and you know, all these different types of shows, and then now you're doing the filmmaking, and you've done writing, Rustamouth. I didn't know for a long time that was you, you know. That show was big too, Rustamouth. Big up for you for Rustamouth. And all these things, and it's like, do you feel like now this is the lane?
No. What I mean, it's kind of
a mixtape.
No, I did that. I did that before.
You had a mixtape?
Yeah, I did it.
No, you're not. You're lying to me.
Bro, I was on
Bro, listen, before. You know that's my new jingle for this podcast. It's Reggie J's mixtape. I hope you give me the licenses.
Hilarious. So pre One Extra, I was on Pirate. I was on Freak FM. So I was on the same station as Heartless Crew and Dream Team and EZ and all the rest. Yeah.
So when did we have to get into this very, very, very much. Unless you don't want to talk about it. But how long did you spit for?
Long time. My dad's a musician. I was making music for years. I was producing for a little while. I was in a group. We like played Napa, we played Malia, we did all the islands, was on Pirates.
And how old
was
you at this point?
17.
Okay, 17, so you're really enjoying it.
Yeah, I was a kid. And so I was on Taste FM in South, I was on Freak FM in North, in Finsbury Park. And we were doing all the raves, we were doing all the clubs. And I was an MC and I sometimes DJ'd. And then I started making music, and then I turned down a record deal and turned down a product.
You turned down a record deal?
Let's not get into
that. Okay.
But I turned down a publishing deal and a record deal when I was... No. Oh, forgive me. I got to show my age. I turned down a publishing deal. We were talking about the record deal, but I had two offers on my publishing deal when I was 22, 23. Okay. And, you know, I made like over 200 songs and I was ready to do something. But God rest his soul, an amazing guy called Richard Antry, who's a music lawyer. He was my music lawyer. He like, Adele called me when she, because I met Adele on MySpace, and Adele hit me up. She was looking for a lawyer, and I sent her to Richard. He did Adele's deal. He did Mr. Hudson. He did a bunch of people. So Richard,
the deal was bad.
No, he came through to me, and it was good deal. It was good money. It was amazing people. People are still friends with now. And he basically said to me, right, for you to do this, you're going to have to step away from TV for a year. And at the time, I was, I think I was doing Doctor Who, Top of the Pops, and One Extra.
Okay.
And he was like, you got to step away from all of that for a year to do this properly, to record it, to tour it, to promote it. And I was like, well, I've been doing this for like going on 15 years.
You built a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know if I want to. And he was like, okay, think about it. And so I put a fork in it and I stepped away.
How long did it take you to decide to put a fork in that?
It was a night.
A night?
Yeah, I just slept on it and... You know,
that's a big thing to walk away from, man.
It is and it isn't.
Well, I mean, it is a big thing, but you also did have that thing. I guess, is it because you had built so much and to step away from it?
It's yeah, like... I think even at that age, I realised that I had a really unique opportunity to just shift perception, to do something that had never been done. You know, I was the youngest presenter of Top of the Pops at the time. I was the only black guy presenting the programme. I was, you know, one of the youngest people at 1X. I was on Doctor Who, which is, you know, it's a behemoth in itself. I was doing... really cool stuff and stuff that I never thought I would have been. Yeah, stuff that I never thought I would have ever achieved. And at that point I thought, shit, what's next? If I keep doing this, where is this gonna go? Whereas if I do the music thing, I'm just another rapper. And we all know how that can go.
Yeah.
So I decided to actually focus on the thing that I'd given over a decade to at that point. And here we are.
Yeah, you know? It worked out.
It kind of did.
It's not like a sad story. I'm gonna go like, fuck, poor Reggie, man.
Exactly.
You should have took that deal, man.
Now I've got a serious drug problem.
Yeah.
No, I mean, so to answer your previous question about is documentaries where I wanted to end up? No, I didn't see this coming, and I didn't imagine that I'd be here. The truth is, I always thought I'd be a filmmaker, just not this kind of filmmaker. So writing and directing is something that I've done for a long time, quite quietly. And I made sure 4 short films, and I'm in the process of finalising my first feature film script that's been commissioned.
Fantastic.
And it's very exciting, and we should be shooting next summer.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I'll be directing it as well. And I just sold, I don't want to jinx it, but I've just sold a comedy drama in the States, which is really exciting.
Great.
So I'm taking the network, I'm having those network conversations fairly imminently. So yeah, I mean, writing and directing is something that I've always done, but I've just not really spoken about it because it's been my own thing. And it's only now that it's real that I'm really talking about it.
And what is it about the directing you like?
It's the most creatively fulfilling thing I've ever done. along with Ryan, to me they're one and the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't be I wouldn't call myself an auteur. I feel like a wanker calling myself that, but it's the auteur theory.
Well, you
know?
Just did,
yeah, kind of. It's that thing. Well, no, it's that thing of seeing an idea out.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, like for me, there is nothing more fulfilling than having an idea in like just walking down the street, having a poo, washing the dishes, having something pop into your head, and then 6 months later being on a set with 100 people asking you questions and they're all there for you, and this idea that you had that you could have thrown away, but instead you actually wrote something. And you know, I'm not really interested in a passer. So everything that I write and everything that I create, I feel has some sort of value and potentially has some level of impact to it. So to be able to create something that can actually affect change is a huge thing for me. So as someone who was an actor for years, you are Pinocchio. You're saying somebody else's words. You're being lit in the way that suits somebody else. You're being directed. Your performance is being crafted by someone else. Think about that. Your performance, somebody else is shaping in their vision. Fuck that. For me, what is way more important is seeing out an idea. Being Geppetto is far more powerful.
Do you feel honest now?
Yeah. I mean, I've never felt dishonest, but I feel that I'm walking in my truth in a way that I never have done. And to be able to actually execute ideas that I think are valuable as opposed to executing what somebody else thinks is of value or timely or important. You know, I'm about to make a documentary on Black Hollywood. And, you know, I'm making a film about some of the loudest creative voices in the world right now are African Americans who are existing underneath the governance of Trump. Like, how does that even happen? You know, we all know what happened with the Harlem Renaissance. Is this going to crash in the same way? To make that film and to have the BBC say, we want to see that film from you, it's amazing. And then to get my brethren to direct it, it's such it's a blessing. Big Yemi Bam. It is a director who you've worked on Hate Thy Neighbor.
Black brother.
It's an incredible creative more than anything. So for me to be in that position where I'm blessed enough and being given those opportunities is huge for me. So yeah, I think that there is far more power and far more potential in being the person who creates the content as opposed to being the mouthpiece of somebody else's ideas.
Yeah, I guess because there is that thing of having a thought in your mind and then it manifesting itself into something in actuality and something real and something, you know, and potentially something that you, is like you said, make an impact. But when did that idea come up? Because we keep on coming back to impact and this sort of notion of making difference and sort of using your creative and using your art to actually have something of substance. Because and you know, it's not even to diss the other stuff. Because look, sometimes, you know, like, listen, I love watching Spike Lee's Malcolm X. But then sometimes you just got to watch them Love Island. You know what I'm saying? You got to switch off from the world. I made 16 episodes on racism. Sometimes I want to watch some cheaters. You know what I'm saying? Like, I can't. You know what I'm saying? But you
absolutely.
Know, there's room for both. And I think people get too bogged down in one or the other.
Yeah.
Everything exists in this world. That's what makes the world great. So people out there, don't fucking, you know, I don't know, these people are going to start tweeting me. Listen, don't tweet me or Reggie Yates about this shit. But yeah, so when did this sort of idea come of, like, look, you know what? I need to start making something that has something else.
I can't nail it down to one particular moment, but there are several instances. I'll share a couple with you. One was, and God bless her, she doesn't even know the impact of it. I bumped into a girl that I used to go to primary school with, a girl called Nadia, who lived on the same road as me, Liverpool Road in North London, Island. And Nadia and I hadn't seen each other for years, and she just, and I can't remember, where was we? We was at a Stormzy gig in Island. He played, and his people asked me to come down, and it was early doors and it was wicked and it was lovely to be there for Mike and all the rest of it. And she bumped into me and she was like, Reg, I've seen a bunch of your films. I know I've not seen you in years. I'm just leaving, but I just wanted to say you found your purpose and I'm so proud of you. Kissed me on the cheek and bounced. And I stood there for like 10 minutes holding an orange juice bombs, like, what? That's kind of heavy. I don't know if I'm ready for this purpose talk. But it was really beautiful and it was a really lovely thing. And the other moment that sort of led me down this thought path, if you will, was when I made a documentary about being young, black and gay. Well, black and ethnic minority and gay, so we had young Muslim Pakistani boys.
You went to the nightclub?
Yes.
Because I remember in that film, people were like really hiding from the camera.
Straight up.
That was the most, sorry to cut you off in your line of thought there, but I just have to mention. I remember what really struck me about, because that film was like one of the early films, right?
Ish, right?
I do remember it. Yeah, I remember it's people.
It's on Netflix now if you want to see it.
Catch on Netflix. God damn right, catch on Netflix. But it was how people run away from the camera.
Mm.
And how, you know what I'm saying? That's what really made that film like, damn, for me.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? That moment, it's those little moments like people like.
Well, we went to this this gay club night at Scala in King's Cross, which I've been to a million and one times for different parties and gigs and all the rest of it, but I'd never been there under those circumstances. And to see goons walking in, full tracksuit, do-rag, like beanie, walking in, seeing the camera, pulling the hood over their head and running out of the way, it was like, whoa, okay, this is who you truly are. But you're not ready to share that with the world yet. You're not ready to share that with anyone. It was mind-blowing. So anyway, we made this film, and the reason I wanted to make it was because of somebody else's story. It's not my story to tell, but a family member of mine, someone who I love dearly, came out as gay. And they were really scared that they would be judged for their sexuality. And it broke my heart in a lot of ways. So in talking to him a lot about it, I realized that, you know, for a young gay person to come out is difficult. But a young gay African to come out, with all of the religious hang-ups we have, with all of the cultural sort of steers that we have, it's flipping hard.
It's not. I don't envy that position at all.
Straight up. I decided to make a film on it, and I was really disappointed with the film, if I'm honest with you, because I feel like we could have done more. I felt like there was more to the story that we could have said, and what I thought is neither here nor there, because the point I'm trying to make is that I allowed my ego to get in the way of the way I felt about the film. As the credits rolled, I did what I always do when I check social media to see what people thought, unfiltered. And between Snapchat, Insta and Twitter, I got, I think it was 6 or 7 messages that all echoed the same thing. And that was, I sat down with my parents to watch this, and by the time the credits came on, I came out to them. Because of what we were saying and what we felt during the making of this film, during the watching of the film. And for me, that was like a real wake up call that the content that I am making can actually do something for someone. It's literally changed those people's lives. And yeah, you might say, okay, cool, 2 million people watched and 6 people felt affected by it. It's, to me, that 6 people is huge. So there wasn't any one moment, but it was, I've had several moments like that in my life where people have sort of stopped me and said, okay, what you're doing is important, keep doing it. And that just, you know, puts everything into perspective for me. So when, you know, I talk about writing and directing film or TV, I'm talking about drama, I'm talking about comedy, all of it, in my humble opinion, has the potential to do that in a different way. So that's what I feel I've all of these opportunities are built up towards.
Do you ever miss doing the other stuff, like the acting?
No,
because you ain't acted for a minute, right?
Yeah, the last thing I did was, it was Idris Elba's first directing gig. So Idris is a mentor of mine. He and I have like a cool relationship. He put me with, took me to his management, so they look after my writing and directing. At the time, they were looking after my acting. So he put me in the first thing he directed called Pavement Psychologist, where I paid Anna Friel's assistant and Nonzo was in. It was great, and it was a cool thing to do. But that was 6 years ago, five years ago, something like that. And I knew that it wasn't where I wanted to be, because as an actor, I never really cared enough. Truth be told, I was crapping auditions because I couldn't retain lines, because I always struggled with other people's writing. It didn't feel like it had the rhythm of speech.
Oh, Reggie, you ain't never seen my auditions. You want to see a bad audition, fam? I'll get you some tapes, bruv. I've got like, yo, I'm in this one film, bruv. Yeah, I'm not going to say the name of this film. And when I tell you my acting,
you've got to tell us that. Come on.
Nah. I'll tell you. I ain't telling these animals out there. When I tell you my acting in there is just like, give me the money now.
What
like,
was your part?
Street Thug. Street Thug 4. Nah, I was one of the goons, and it was in this short film, and oh my God, I was like, I've just never had that, you know, penance in terms of, the only acting I've ever done as well is, you know, improvised acting.
Right.
It's more just like,
I feel with acting, you have to care, because people can tell if you don't care about the craft, it comes out. And I did for a while, and I think the minute I stopped caring and the minute I stopped investing in it, my craft, it just fell through the floor. And I found far more fulfillment in writing and or directing and working with actors now. I love, because I'm able to give the direction that I never received.
You still do the presenting?
It's weird because some people would say the documentaries I present, but I don't think I do.
I think it's different. I class the documentary, and this is just me. Who the fuck am I? But I'd say that is filmmaking, and that's documentary making. When I say present, I mean like.
See, I think the role that I'd say the same for you in some of your films. I see myself as a complicit contributor, right? I'm aware of the process, but I am part of the process. That's not a presenter. I don't talk down the lens. I talk to my director and we have a conversation. So whenever I work with a new director, which is rare these days because I have the people that I like to work with, whenever I work with a new director, I tell them, like, we need to talk. We need to have a conversation. That will be the dialogue. Ask me questions. Don't just put the camera on me and go, so what do you think? It's conversational. I think the minute that you're having a conversation with the audience, with your director, you're basically having a conversation with a man on the couch. And that's the person that I'm trying to speak to at all times, regardless of the level of content.
But when I'm in prison, I mean like the Toe the Pop stuff or the...
I think I'm kind of done. I think I'm done with that stuff. I mean, it's great. And I've really enjoyed it. I think it's project dependent, you know. If it's the right thing, then maybe. But I just get so much out of the factual stuff. To be given the opportunity, I appreciate that. To be given the opportunity to do something like Grenfell that means so much, you know, to make a film like that.
That's a powerful film, still.
But to be given the opportunity to do that, that requires. I mean, I'm being handed a lot of responsibility there, not just by the Beeb, but by, you know, I'm giving a platform to the residents, to the people directly affected by what happened.
That's a hard story to tell because it's not, you know, it's not your story.
Yes,
it's their story, and it's not your tragedy. It's their tragedy, and plus it's like it could be so easily misrepresented, and as well it's easy to kick people while they're down.
Yeah,
because it's such a, you know, what happened there is fucked.
Which is why which is why I was adamant about it not being a political film. It was a film about the people, and it was a film about how they dealt with what happened that night and how they're trying to rebuild their lives and move forward, and also to reflect the fact that it was global, you know, affected people all around the world. And to actually give a face to some of those names and portraits on the memorial wall, that was what we were trying to do. There were lots of other films that did incredible things that spoke to a lot of the issues that we didn't touch on. But I'm old enough and ugly enough to know what I'm not good at, dude. So I just focus on what I know I'm great at. And I say, no, I'm great. I know I'm getting better at all the time.
Great. It's all right.
No. Genuinely, I feel that I've got to a level with it, and I feel like I'm getting stronger with it. And that is being able to give people a platform and to be themselves and to genuinely express themselves in a very real way.
And it sounds like you invested in it, which is the crux of anything to be good is investment. You said you're DJ as well. Talking about purpose of life. DJ, no, because I what type of what cause I know you DJ, but what music do you DJ? I never actually asked
I
you
play
about
well it's difficult because I got asked that question all the
club
time.
Club bangers, is that what the kids are calling it now, the club bangers?
I get asked all the time, what sort of music do you like?
Yeah,
I like, it's a really ambiguous and annoying answer. I like good music. So again, it's very personal because it's
you're a hip-hop dude as well, isn't it?
I grew up on that, but at the same time, you know, I grew up, my mum used to keep this ghetto blaster above the cooker that was covered in every kind of oil and every kind of food splatter you can think of, because it was fixed there, and she used to listen to the Pirates when she would cook. So she would jump from WNK and Choice FM when they were Pirates, and Kiss when they were Pirates, to some of the commercial stations. So I grew up on a diet of pop stuff like Whitney Houston and The Police and, you know, Talking Heads. And at the same time, we were listening to Maxi Priest and Shabba and whatever else was
going.
Right. And then we were also listening to Jungle. We were listening to whatever else was going on, because we would bounce between commercial stations and the Pirates. So my musical taste has always been broad. And what do I like? I just like good music. So I like to blend stuff in tempos. If you're at 130 BPM, I could play, I don't know, I could play anything from the OJs right the way through to a UK garage record. It's about if it blends and if it feels right, that's what
I'll
play.
So you're 35, so you must have been around the garage time.
Bro, garage
is your era, isn't it?
That's my life, man. Special moment for me. I just put up a UK garage mix a couple of days ago on my SoundCloud.
My pops was, my dad was the original type of dude. He had a gold tooth.
Wicked.
And he had the dreads on the top, shave on the sides, and he was a jungle dude.
Oh, so and your dad was on the back of spliffy jeans?
Yeah, yeah. My dad. Yep, damn right, man. He's wearing Balenciaga and all that. And he started on the jungle, and then my dad went to obviously the drum and bass, and then UK garage. And he used to listen to the UK garage. We used to always have that the woman singing on it.
Okay,
you know, when it was like the soulful UK garage and all that stuff. And then when I adopted it, it sort of went more darker garage.
Okay,
then went into grime, and that's when I was coming up, was more of a grime era. So when you were spitting, you was probably spitting on like
the happier stuff.
The happier stuff.
When I fell out, well, not so much fell out of love with it, but grew out of it. It was becoming more MC led.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I was into it, it was MCs were kind of like hosts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And my favorite MCs were the ones who were kind of like a cross between
the two.
But they
were master of ceremonies, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Oli, oi, oi, oi.
Those guys I couldn't bear, right? I'm from North London originally. I mean, I moved to Southeast when I was 14, but in North London, it was heartless or die. You know, if you were North London, you were heartless. If you were East, you were pay as you go.
Do you want to listen to the other day?
Go on.
I listened to Pay As You Go versus Heartless Crew.
Destiny Watford.
Yeah, yeah.
Legendary.
And then he goes, pay as you go, credit done.
Yeah,
amazing. That line, it was just, you hear the horns and that.
Bushkin,
yo,
man.
It was that Mighty Mo. And
Mighty Mo was my favorite MC.
It was great.
I spazzed out when I saw Mighty Mo. He was wearing a beige pair of Huaraches.
Yeah.
And he was wearing an Off Key Machino shirt. And I was like, you don't even understand. You're my guy. Like, I remember Rose, our art teacher, she used to let us call her by her Christian name. She used to let us play Heartless Crew tapes while we were doing art, because it was the only thing that would shut us up, and we'd just draw and we'd all be bopping along to Mighty Mo.
Heartless Crew was the, I saw them one time. Mighty Mo Bush. No, was it Bushkin there? But I think Bushkin was there. Mm. It was Heartless Crew, and it might have been Bushkin just left, so it might not have been there. But I saw them in Shoreditch, at this club in Shoreditch. It's the one in that goes into the basement, and it was just great.
Listen, I love Heartless so much. My 30th birthday party, I had David Rodigan and Heartless play.
Damn.
That was the soundtrack to my 30th birthday.
David Rodigan, that's another G.
That's my guy.
I love watching that guy. I always watch all these videos of him clashing.
Yeah.
And it's like David Rodigan.
In sandals.
Yeah, in sandals.
And socks.
And everyone's throwing up the gun finger.
Yeah, he's amazing.
And he's got dubs that no one ain't got.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He's
Rodigan's
got proper
incredible
war dubs. You can't go against Rodigan, man.
To answer your question, I was a product of the UK garage era because of my age. Uh-huh. And you know, my cousins in South were listening to So Solid while we were listening to Heartless, and all my boys in East were listening to Pay As You Go and Wiley, and all of that graduated into something new, and essentially what happened in East London ended up becoming grime and sort of ruled everything else irrelevant.
Did you like grime?
I still do. I love it. As grime, as garage became grime, it was really exciting because that was where you saw certain MCs elevate, like Kano, who was a garage MC and came from the same school as the rest of us, of Mighty Mo and you know, Major Ace and all these other
Major Ace, all these other
MCs that we love.
Didn't
coming
Major
up.
Pass away, I think.
Pardon?
Major passed away recently.
This year he passed away earlier.
But he
came up in the same era. But then he graduated into grime, you know. When he made Boys Love Girls, it was like, wow, that just.
Yeah.
And then when Dizzy made I Love You, and
that
was making those
different.
Beats,
I remember when that came out, I Love You. I remember when that came out. I remember watching. It was the same as that and Oi when that came out, but it's the same feeling. It was just, all I wanted was that Daredevil jumper he had. He had this cold Daredevil jumper. And I remember when Morfire Crew came out, all I wanted was an Avericks leather.
Yeah.
All I wanted was an Avericks leather and an R6 bike. That's all I wanted, bro. I was 13, bro. All I knew was I wanted this bike and that leather jacket.
See, it was weird for me because we're all the same age. So me, Diz, Kano, Lethal, all of us, we're all the same age. And we were all doing garage at the same time. They never heard of me because I never made it on the level that they made it as a garage MC. But to see the influence that they had when we were in our early 20s was incredible. I stopped making music and I pivoted back to TV. Mm-hmm. But to see them be gods, you know, to see them walk on stage at Sidewinder or any of those things
Eskimo.
And just win on a different level, be gods to kids was incredible.
Yeah, the one thing about grime that I kind of, it's probably not a thoughtful idea, but when I was coming up, like, I think grime's sort of gone through, it's at the Renaissance now and it's sort of come back and it's powerful and, you know, Stormzy has a great deal. And I saw Stormzy live for the first time. I was one of the best live performers I've seen in a long time. Duke can perform.
The chosen one.
Great, amazing musician. But it's, you know, when it first came out, it's like, because people were like, oh, this is like the new punk. But we just never treated it like it was cultural. We just saw it as music and we never held on to it like culture. You know, we never we never really appreciated what that music was and what came with that music, you know.
I think
we kind of let it go to, because like we, you know, because grime was out, and how long before it became commercialized and before we sort of, you know, gave it up a bit. But I have to feel like it's because that how culturally strong that impacted. It's only now we sort of look at it in hindsight and go, oh yeah, back then, you know, it was great. Because when punk was going on, those punks held on to it. And they're like, this is punk, and this, you know what I'm saying? And they, you know, but we never, and I feel like, you know, people with around my age group, you know, I feel like we, you know, in hindsight, it would have been nice if we would have really, you know, me included. I'm not saying I'm better than thou, you know.
But the beautiful thing about that story is that it didn't die.
It
had a renaissance, and now you could argue it's stronger than ever. And that's the beautiful thing about garage now. You've got people my age who are in their mid-30s who are able to go to garage raves again. And, you know, I've seen posters for Sidewinder today. All of those people that made the scene what it was are not just alive. They're still kicking. They're still doing bits. And seeing Heartless doing Boiler Room.
MC Neat and...
Sorry?
It's good to see like the old MCs and that still working.
Yeah, that's cool. It's cool that they are still working, but I think it's cool that there is still a scene for people to plug back into. Should you want to seek it out, it still exists. And it's a time capsule, man. It's a beautiful moment. And without giving too much away, I'm actually making a project about the UK garage scene at the moment. And I'm so excited for it to be real because it's my youth. And when you think about some of your favourite coming-of-age films or coming-of-age projects, you know, they capture and put in a bottle that lightning that was a moment that was really special to a generation of people. And I don't think anyone's done that for UKG yet. So I'm really excited to be one of the people that is hopefully doing that.
All right, man, I'm going to let you go, Reggie. Before we leave, I just want to say thank you. You know, you're a man, you know, you are busy and you know, you took out time for me today. I really appreciate it, man. I just want to say I appreciate you and what you do. And it sounds like, you know, and you do it with a certain walk. And you do have a certain stride, and you walk in your way, and I respect that.
Thank you, sir. You know, I appreciate that.
And you know, and you're a kind brother too, and I do appreciate that as well. But you know, you're putting something out there that means something. And it's, you know, in a world where, you know, it'd be easy just to take the check.
Yeah.
You know, and no, people out there don't understand that, but I understand that. It's easy to take the check, brother. It's hard to say no.
Yeah.
And
for
to
real.
Say, you know, I need to do it this way because it's right.
It's difficult to take the smaller check too.
It's difficult to take the smaller check. Right. For real. And that's it, man. But you know, you're doing it your way.
Yeah, I appreciate
it. It's not easy to do it your way in this game, man. But you're doing it, and I appreciate it. So thank you for coming down, man.
Can I be really cheeky and plug something?
No, brother. Yeah, of course.
I don't normally plug things, but I've just started my podcast again. You know, you were gracious enough to come on the previous iteration of my podcast, which was Talk Stew. We did 10 episodes of that, and now we started again with the Reggie Yates podcast, and that is really gathering some steam, and it feels good, and it's nice.
It's called the Reggie Yates podcast.
Just called the Reggie Yates podcast. So guys, please, guys,
subscribe to Reggie Yates podcast. After you listen to this one, pause this. And go subscribe to Reggie Yates podcast.
Give me 5 stars.
Five stars too, because he deserves it. And I know it's going to be good. I'm actually going to listen to that as well. I know he's got great guests coming down. And do you know what? Pick up. You got the book out. The book still. You can still book. Still
available? Yeah. I mean, the book is out there, and you can get that wherever. But what I wanted to say actually is, and this isn't me trying to get you to come back over to my show at all. This is about something that's way bigger than me. On the second episode of the show, we had the Deputy Mayor of London come on,
right,
and he spoke about a £45 million fund that Sadiq Khan has ring-fenced for young creative projects. So if you are creative and you want to do something in your community, say you live in a council estate and you want to put on a film festival for your estate, the London mayor has £45 million to help make that happen. So please go online and look it up. I don't know the URLs. It's not my initiative. It was something that was said and something that really excited me. Yeah. So if you have something that you want to do,
and I'm going to Instagram that, because that's amazing.
Yeah, if there's something that you want to do.
Because you know what the problem is? Like, there is some stuff out there for young creatives, but it's just hard to find it. And so if I can be the vehicle for that message to get out there. So go out and look for that. And yeah, Reggie, man, you know, you ain't going nowhere, my brother. You got a longer career.
Are you chaining me to the chair? What do you mean?
Yeah. I've locked the door. You ain't got nowhere. We got another hour left.
You kill me because we're finished.
Yeah, for real. That's it, is it?
You ain't going nowhere.
I've already got my interview. We don't need Reggie nowhere. No. But real talk, man. I look forward to the next stuff you got coming out.
Thank you.
It's going to be great. And yeah, man. Thank you so much, my brother.
Thank you for having me.
Jamali Nah. Jamali. Jamali 9000 from Mars. Just land over Max with the computer. My wings expand on Earth, around the universe. The superhero just written a verse. The J on my shirt for Jamali. Never using a Molly.
Walking down the galaxy, computers on my hand. Built in like I'm a man machine since I was growing up with children. Mechanical rapper putting a robot flow together. I'm made of steel in any weather. Disguised more than Spider-Man in a sweater. Optimus way after prime. Standing on top of the world, I gotta shine. Just like my pop's new Cadillac CT6. The patch on my eye, I be Rick. The lyrics are slick, like new now wave grease.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.